Welcome to 4.0 to Pro, the pickleball podcast that focuses on a single shot, tip, or strategy to improve your pickleball game with every single pocket-sized episode. Our goal is to make you better on the court every time you hear our voices. And now your hosts, 4.something Michael O'Neill and USA Pickleball National Silver Medalist, Senior Pro Scott Fliegelman.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of 4.0 to Pro, your pocket-sized pickleball podcast where we teach you a single shot or strategy every single episode. I'm Michael O'Neill here in sunny Phoenix or Glendale, Arizona, and not a foot and a half from me. Right there across the table is one Scott Fliegelman, also here in Glendale, Arizona. Hello, Scott.
Hello, Michael. Welcome to the National Pickleball League Championship Weekend.
I have been told, by the way, that when we plug the National Pickleball League, that we have to do the full URL, which is, I think, nplpickleball.com. Is that correct?
Sounds about right. NPL Pickleball.
Because there's another National Pickleball League that sort of made a website.
Pales
it's
in
not
comparison.
The same thing. Yeah. But this is the finals of the NPL, which is the Champions League, the 50-plus pros. It's set up very much like MLP, where there's a team event. And you are on the Denver Iconics, and you've had a pretty fun season overall.
Yeah, we didn't show up yesterday. We had the fifth versus fourth matchup, and we lost to a pretty impressive Naples squad. We're not out of it. We're still playing for positioning and cash.
Okay.
We're going to play either the Oklahoma City team or the Indianapolis team in about an hour and a half.
All right. Well, let's get this show on the road, hey. So this, guys, is going to be a, I would say, the most oft-requested show of our little time here, which is the singles episode. That is, again, how to find a romantic partner on the pickleball court. Now, this is going to be geared towards singles players. However, as you and I discussed before we started recording, there are a ton of things that a doubles player can take from the singles court to improve their doubles game.
Yeah, I think most pickleball players who focus on doubles could really benefit from practicing singles, playing singles, entering into a singles draw. There's a lot of benefits, whether you have a tennis background or not. Hopefully we'll convince you in this show to give singles a shot.
Well, I love the idea of when I warm up as well, sometimes I'll go the opposite way where instead of starting with dinking, I'll just be like, hey, do you mind if we start with a few groundies and just hit a few sort of gentle ground strokes and actually get my legs moving a little bit?
Tell me you're a tennis dork without telling me you're a tennis
100%
dork.
Yeah, 100% with the groundies, the groundies and the twoies. But yeah, so it gets me running around a little bit. And as you know, one of my biggest challenges is that my knees are so sore that I need to get some blood flowing into them before I can really start playing. And running around and hitting ground strokes does that for me. So sometimes I'll flip the script on my warm-up a little bit.
Yeah, I like to do the same, whether it's doubles or singles, at the kitchen line. The dinks themselves are superfluous. It's just a more fun way to get the body moving than what I do at other times with my clinics is we put the paddles down and we go through a movement routine.
Right.
But hitting a ball back and forth is more fun.
It's totally more fun. So one major factor, I think, in singles that is super important in doubles, but maybe not to this extreme, is the depth of your serve. Serve depth in singles is so critically important because typically on return of serve in singles, that returner jams right up to the line. And if there's anything you can do to delay that presence at the line, you're going to probably win more points or have the opportunity to hit the third to them in the transition zone.
Yeah, in general, and again, this is the 4.0 to Pro show, so singles players out there, you are either already aspiring to make it to the non-volley zone before your opponent, or your opponents are doing that better than you. In beginning singles, you'll see a little bit more ground stroke rallies going on, but we would like to have our serve, just like it is in doubles, either delay or dissuade the returner from following their return of serve into the non-volley zone. And if we can do either one of those, we've set ourselves up to win a point on serve.
What's interesting about it as well is that there's things in doubles, like you never want to make a service fault in doubles, but if you make a service fault in singles because that ball came in hot and was 2 inches deep, you're going to take that because you're going to want to modify that and adjust it a little bit because it's so critically important for that ball to be that deep in the corner.
Yeah, if I hit a serve 2 to 6 inches long, A, I've not lost a point.
Right.
I lost an opportunity to, but it was the correct serve location, and the wind picked up a little bit, or it just came off a little hotter off the paddle, and that's a good mistake.
One of the things that we talked about a few episodes ago was that sort of pre-serve routine and trying to keep the exact same swing and routine, and then just adjust your depth to the baseline as you serve. And that can, you know, if you're getting close to the baseline or you're a little long and you can step back 6 inches but keep the exact same stroke, you're going to pin that ball in the corner and have a little more success with it.
True. And on this show and a lot of the lessons that I teach, yeah, I've been pushing the importance of backing up quite a bit off
right.
the line for both serve and return. Just because there's a line there doesn't mean we need to stand on it.
Right.
And there's usually only 8 feet of room behind the serving line anyway before the fence or the wall shows up. I like to use most of it. But to your point, and I've thought about this since you brought this up several shows ago, of just kind of modulating your distance from the baseline with serving in mind, depth in mind, wind in mind. I think that's a good tip.
The other thing that I think is pretty interesting is that you don't pay for aggression as much in singles as you do in doubles. It's important to do that. But weirdly, and having the same effect, you can hit a high serve that also keeps somebody back that isn't as aggressive. You're probably not going to net that ball. You might hit it long, depending on what your stroke looks like, but you're a real advocate of hitting, like, arcing high serves in singles and doubles.
I do that in both. I feel like in the last couple of NPL events here, I've had more opponents come up to me to share how impactful my serve has been, and I would say the key has been the height wrapped in topspin.
Right.
And
right.
In singles, yeah, the height, I'm not going to serve into the net. And my goal, whether it's singles or doubles, is if I can get that player on their back foot, if I can get them backing up, then as I said earlier, I'm either going to delay or dissuade their venture forward to the non-volley zone. Secondarily, and this may be new for you, is I use a lot of different baseball analogies for some reason or another. We'll talk about viewing serving from a starting pitcher standpoint in a second. But if I can get that ball to come from 8, 10, 12 feet on high with topspin, I can get the ball to bounce outside of their strike zone, above their strike zone.
Right.
Which means either A, they're going to hit the ball at chest or shoulder high, which is not their preferred strike zone. That's
right.
Not where they want to swing their paddle. Or B, they're going to need some really crisp hand-eye coordination and likely a serious tennis background to figure out how best to take the ball on the rise.
Right, to short hop it.
Yeah. Yeah,
right.
And I'll take either one of those.
Yeah.
I mean, they'll get a handful of them deep, but some of them they're going to shank, some of them are going to land short. So let's not undervalue the importance of a ball that bounces up, not just to their waist, like every other serve comes up to their waist. They can calibrate on that right away. Let's see if we can't play with a serve that bounces up chest or shoulder high.
I love that. And this is one of those things that, again, in singles or doubles, you can easily set up 3 cones on each tee and then in the middle of that service box, pull out a bag of balls and just hit a bunch of serves. Like, figure your serve out. And I gotta say, it's so rare for me to show up to a court, even with people that are aspiring to get better and that are drilling, that I see do this. Like, have a huge basket of balls and are just hitting 300 serves just to figure out all of these things. The other thing I think we can take advantage of is pickleball courts are notoriously short behind the baseline. There's a tennis net there or there's a fence there. So if you can back them all the way up, you know, whether it's by bringing the heat and having a little bit of power with your topspin with some of these new carbon-type paddles that can arc a ton of topspin on, and then you get that ball deep, and someone's got to really struggle with that return. Or in your case, you hit that lovely high arcing ball, and you've got them slammed their back onto the fence. It's a huge advantage, I think.
I agree, and let's talk about how I view serving, whether it's singles or doubles, like a starting pitcher.
Mm.
I don't want to have just one pitch, which for a lot of players is just the fastball.
Sure.
You know, they hit that low, aesthetically pleasing ball, you know, 4 inches over the net. I see it land too short too frequently. But even if you get it deep, as I said earlier, it's going to come up somewhere between their knees and their waist.
Right.
And they're going to calibrate on that. You know, it's 3-3 in game one, and they've pretty much got your serve down. And all you have left is lateral location, inside pitch, outside pitch,
right,
from there, but you're not moving up and down in the strike zone. And I think that's really impactful from a serving standpoint to make things more challenging for the returner. Alternative pitches can be the even higher one, a real soft high ball, which when you make them have to generate all their own pace, they don't like that,
right,
a lot of the time. The slider, or when you're serving from the left side, is that ball that, you know, slices out toward the fence, which I know you have in your
I do, and I really love that.
Arsenal.
I was actually just going to suggest the opposite version of that is, if you sit and practice this for a while, you can actually do a backhand serve from the right-hand side that has that same spin to bring them off of the court on the forehand side
as well.
I believe
backhand servers are born. They're not made.
Oh, I see. Okay. I do know. Yeah, yeah. That's for sure.
But it'd be nice to have it. Never occurred to me.
Yeah. It is nice to have in the arsenal.
Yeah. I do want to talk about lateral location.
Okay.
You know, and again, from a starting pitcher standpoint, the inside pitch, outside pitch. Most of us, and it's a great idea if we can identify a weaker wing, which for most opponents is their backhand, then let's be targeting that. We've mentioned on this show before, and it doesn't get a whole lot of attention, is the body serve. If we can get that ball right in on them, their footwork's not all that crisp, it had some spin, it had some pace, that body serve can be really effective, again, in getting a short return and possibly delaying, you know, their forward advancement to the non-volley zone.
I was playing with Jenny yesterday, who I believe is one of the co-owners of OKC. Is that correct?
She's on OKC. Jenny Marcos, awesome singles and doubles player on OKC. Not an owner, though.
When we were practicing serves and returns, all she did was go to my body, and dude, she had some heat on it. She was a former tennis player, so she knew how to hit that ball. It was deep. I struggled with it so much that while she was in her windup, as she was about to hit it, I would move to the left a foot and a half.
That is clever.
So that I had a forehand to hit, because she kept jamming me with this serve, and I kept thinking, man, that is a great pickleball serve right there. So absolutely figure that out to the body. Now, but on return, similar ideas apply, which is if you're the returner in singles, depth is your friend. You want to have enough time to get to that non-volley zone if that is your game. You and I will discuss a little bit about the second shot or the fourth shot. Sometimes I prefer the fourth shot to go to the net. If I don't get the greatest ball on serve and I don't hit this great deep return, I may hang out for a shot and try to find a better approach where I'm a little more balanced and feel more comfortable with it. Obviously, when you watch the pros or most of the high-level people, they are coming right up to the net with their return. And I think it has a lot to do with the mystery of location, which is there a rule where we should return serve in singles?
So here's a key difference between doubles and singles. I think this being the forward approach show that our bread and butter plan A as return of serve is going to be deep and to their weaker wing.
Okay.
And let's start off with assuming that that's their backhand.
Yeah.
And we're going to hit it there whether we're on the right side or we're returning from the left side. From the left side, if it's a right-handed player with a weaker backhand, we have further to run, which we'll talk about in a second. But I think that's plan A.
Yeah.
And we don't move to plan B until the ball has left our paddle and we are able to make a decision, should I continue with plan A, or am I going to hold here?
Right.
I'm going to hold here. The decision there is, if I stick with plan A with this weaker return that happened to go to their stronger wing, I'm probably going to watch the ball blow by me. So that's how I approach things, maybe a little bit differently with lower levels, but forward to pro, we should be the first quote-unquote team at the non-volley zone, and as the returner of serve, that's teed up for us.
Right.
So that's what we want.
I was having a conversation with Matthias Johansson, who's the number one senior pro singles player in the world, multiple times over now. And he said that if he sees that his opponent has a one-handed backhand versus a two, he will pin it to that right rear corner every single time, because it's so difficult to dig a deep one-handed backhand out in that corner. A little easier for a two-y, if you can get a paddle on it, you can actually have a down-the-line shot. There's a little more strength behind it, but he said it's so rare to find somebody that has a one-handed backhand that can dig themselves out of a great corner return like you just described.
Yeah, and the current undisputed second best senior pro men's singles player and former number one, Paul Olin, has one of the sweetest one-handed topspin passing shots in the game.
Yeah.
So that's always a great match if you have a chance to watch those two.
Yeah. So I heard Dave on the PPA live broadcast talking about following your return down the line to cut the angles off. Let's say you're on the right-hand side. You go down the line to that spot we just talked about. Well, now you only have to take a couple of steps into the court because you got the down the line covered, and they have to hit a wicked cross-court backhand to make something palatable on their end. Does the forehand version of that apply as well? If they're on the left side and you rip your return down the line, now they have a forehand. Is it advantageous to take that angle away where they have to hit a really steep cross court forehand, or is it still let's keep bearing them back in the backhand? Because then you have more diagonal room to cover as the person coming to the net. Like you sort of leave yourself almost like if you have a stacked situation where you've now given them a chance, if they can run around it and get a forehand on that, they can just shred it down the line before you can get to cover that spot. You following me?
I follow you. I'm generally a fan of sticking with the plan A that I described is a return deep to the weaker wing.
Yeah.
Even if that's the cross court shot.
Yeah.
But it leads to another tip is let's not be afraid to put a little bit of air under our return so that I buy myself the time to get across court. Same thing we talk about when we're unwinding the stack. Let's put some air under our return. Two pretty good singles players come to mind, Tyson McGuffin and Ben Johns. And a lot of times they will prefer the slice return on their backhand side.
Right.
And they'll put some air under it and they'll jog.
And it's floaty.
It's floaty. It lands a foot or two from the baseline to the backhand side. And even if that opponent wants to run around their backhand and hit a forehand, they've put themselves out of position.
Yeah.
And Ben and Tyson can cover the 20 feet of the net really, really well.
Yeah, that inside out forehand that they would have to hit would be really challenging, I think. So location-wise, same idea applies, though, as serve, whereas depth is the most important part on a return. Agree or disagree?
It is, and that's one of those A-B decision-making factors, is if your depth is not what you aspired to, then we move to plan B. Stay back and potentially look to come in on the fourth.
Right. Very often I'm playing with these 4-5-5-0 players, but they're 30 or 35 or 6-4 and takes two big steps, and now they're at the line. It's like, all right, so my original plan is not going to work. I'm going to have to do something else about that. Very often I'll let them return the ball, use my zillion years of tennis to try to put a nice location on that next ball and then hit the fourth one as an approach like, you know, Mr. Bruno in high school would have been proud of.
I don't know Mr. Bruno, no. But I'm glad he left an impression on
That's
you.
Right.
I'm going to offer an alternative to down the line or cross court return. And that is straight up the middle. And I'll go to this option for return of serve, having survived the whiplash of watching some of my opponents, Matthias comes to mind, of if they're blowing balls by me, because I'm giving him the angle by shooting for the corner, his backhand corner, I'm opening up a couple of angles for them. So the down the middle return, it makes those angles a little bit more difficult. And in Matthias's case in particular, he doesn't have a lot of topspin on his drives. He hits that ball an inch from the net tape amazingly well. But if he's going to go cross court from the middle, either forehand or backhand, he doesn't have a whole lot of dip on that ball.
Right.
So I can maybe get him to hit 6 inches wide from time to time without giving him the angle that's afforded by a deep corner return of serve.
Well, in doubles, we would all like to be, you know, 6'5 and have all the length you can have. In doubles, you know, you can cover that mostly. In singles, having that length is very useful. It's a very useful thing, which is why Matthias does very well. He's a very tall dude. So when you hit that return down the middle, and they're going to pass you on each side, his stretch is going to be much longer than yours or mine. Like, you just can track those balls down. And very often, even on the pro level, you see that first pass, and those guys are, like, kind of leaping to get that first ball. They've just gotten it and have to reestablish themselves. The length is helpful, which is why I think maybe depending on how tall you are, if you can get away with returning in the middle and hanging in the middle and trying to defend on each side. You know what I mean?
And it's one of the reasons for our listeners who watch pro pickleball, you'll see that the women don't come in behind their return of serve as regularly as the men. And there's two reasons for that. The women generally aren't as tall and don't have as much reach. And their opponents have really good passing shots.
Yes.
So if you come in and you're 5'6", 5'7", and you just can't cover the 20 feet all that well by yourself, it may be the better bet to stay back, slug it out with a few ground strokes, and then maybe come in on a better ball than your return of serve.
I have definitely lost to people I should not have, employing the I have to come in on return idea. and just I'm watching myself get burned left and right on passing shots. And my first major tip on that was let me put a little more loft on the ball. And so I'm really established by the time I get there. But even then, I still found myself getting passed a lot. And so I have found that if I've been lucky enough to beat one of these young sort of 4-5 or 5-0 guys, generally I do wait till the fourth, and that helps me out a little bit. I don't know. Maybe the game is evolving. I think we would all love to be able to hit that return and get to the net instantly and be able to cover it. But don't be afraid to experiment with the second or the fourth getting to the net.
Right on.
Ground strokes, which are something that we don't really practice that much in doubles, are obviously one of the most critical things in singles. So first and foremost, we've talked about the forehand, we've talked about the backhand, we've had them both on this show already. If you want to hear about how to like dial those shots in, please go back and listen to those previous episodes. Generally though, if you want to get yourself kind of ready for singles, you haven't played singles in a tournament forever, what would you do to prep for, all right, I'm going to have to hit a bunch of ground strokes and get this together? What would your training regimen be to get going?
A lot of ball machine time.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's one of the best uses of a ball machine are ground strokes.
Or a wall, if you don't have one, I suppose.
Yeah, or a wall. I'll tweak the answer just a little bit for our listeners who haven't played much singles, who, you know, may be looking for ways to improve the ground strokes in their doubles game. And my answer is play and practice singles.
Yeah.
If you want a better third shot drive, a great way to do that is to practice your singles.
Right.
And you're just going to get an awful lot of time to practice your ground strokes. Otherwise, as we've said on the show, there aren't a whole lot of ground strokes, or nor should there be in doubles.
Right.
But you know, most players want a better drive, and singles is a great way to get that.
You have here on our notes one passing shot and smother. Explain the smother part to me.
That's not incredibly obvious?
It's not.
As tennis dorks, former tennis players, we can fall a little bit too in love with our ground strokes. Mm. And we visualize ourselves back there as Andre Agassi just whacking away at beautiful passing shots. And I remind players all the time, we're trying to play tennis with radically inferior equipment on a tiny court.
Right.
No strings, no felt on the ball, no rubber core. I prefer, and I will coach accordingly, that if we get a look at a passing shot, take one pretty good swing at a passing shot, shrink the court a bit, bring it in a little, and visualize that opponent, as you kind of described earlier, off balance, needing to recover from that stab volley that they made. And if you stand back there on the baseline admiring your passing shot, getting ready for another passing shot, you haven't accomplished much.
Right.
Instead, and this is a really great drill, and J.W. Johnson does this beautifully, Federico Staxer does this beautifully, take a crack at a passing shot and don't admire it. Or if you admire it, do it from closer to the net.
Right.
Begin coming forward. Cut off the angles. Smother. Aspire to get that next ball out of the air. And while they're off balance recovering from their stab volley, you've got court to hit that ball into. Rick Witskin also does a beautiful job of this in the senior game at 6'3", 6'4". He'll hit his passing shot. I think I've hit a decent volley. And all of a sudden I look up and this 6'4 train is coming at me. He gets the ball out of the air. I thought it was going to bounce.
Right.
It didn't bounce. He hits it into the open court. Good for him.
He completely shrunk the court and shrunk the amount of time that you have to react and set yourself up for that next ball. So that's super helpful. The one thing I think is really interesting, too, that you mentioned before we started, and something I've never heard anybody talk about, which is try, next time you play singles with your buddy or your singles partner, try just for fun. Play it like you would doubles. Do what we just said, hard return, deep serve, you know, deep serve, deep return. But think about more drops than you might normally. I think what happens is people just assume, like you said, we're Agassi in his prime just trying to rip passing shots around. But we can't forget that we've got another player on the team, and that is that 7 feet of space in the non-volley zone on the other side. It can buy us time. And if you can get a ball into that with a drop, just like you would in doubles, you're going to have a better opportunity to cut those angles off and get into the sort of cat and mouse game, which, you know, just don't do it with Ben Johns, but everybody else.
If you come from a nice tennis background, then I subscribe to the plan A I just described. Take a crack at a conservative passing shot and smother.
Yeah.
If you don't have a big tennis background, trying that strategy, you're just not going to put enough balls in play. You probably play a lot of doubles. You probably hit a lot of third shot drops. You already have those skills. Don't forget them just because there's no partner on the same side of the net as you. So to your point, a third shot drop into the 7x20 foot safe space is a great way for you to get up there and play a two-person ritual kitchen exchange,
right,
which is the first time we've ever said that. on the show, but that's a much better way to go versus taking swings at passing shots without the requisite groundstroke skills that you may have 3 years from now.
Right.
But it's not going to happen next Tuesday, but you're already pretty good at third shot drops, so why don't we give that a shot? Now, that's going to require some athleticism to get up there and play doubles by yourself.
Yeah.
You've got a lot of court to cover, but, you know, ideally your opponent is of similar athletic ability, and a cat and mouse game of playing kitchen ball by yourself may be the best way to go without the glorious ground strokes.
Right, and especially if you hit that return and they block that ball back and now you're mid-transition zone. Very often I see people just continue to try to rip ground strokes there when really the drop and neutralizing is a much more strategic advantage in that case.
Same as doubles we talk about all the time. A third shot drive followed by a fifth shot drop is a 100%. Great way to go. The fifth shot drive, not such a good play. Really good time for your opponent to read the clues, step out of the way and go ole.
Yeah.
You know, that happens in singles all the time too. Singles letting out balls go out is if not more important than in doubles.
Sure.
To my point earlier about Matias, who doesn't have a lot of topspin on the ball, the one time that I beat him, I let balls that were 3 inches above the net tape go out, and the ones that were 2 inches above the net tape landed in.
Right.
You know, I just needed to be calibrated on that and gamble.
Yeah.
A little bit.
There's a specific shot in singles that I think everyone should practice. Now, this depends on what, you know, whatever side your backhand is on, but I've served, my opponent has returned, they've returned it, burying it to my backhand, like we talked about at the beginning of the show. Now they're at the net, they're very established. They've hit a great deep backhand return. They're sitting on that tee in the kitchen or even a little bit towards the line, ready for what I'm going to do. I don't have a ton of offensive options. I've seen Scott Fliegelman once or twice on the run, rip a two-handed backhand down the line that curves into the court. In fact, I saw you do that on a live tournament feed once, and I was like, I gave you a high five.
Heck yeah.
Virtually. It was dope. However, barring that, which is a magician shot, you got to do something else. And your best bet's going to be to try to do a cross-court drop. You've got a little more space. So now I'm aiming for their left side and doing a cross-court loopy drop shot to give me a little bit of time to stabilize myself and get back into the point. It's something I've drilled a zillion times.
I had the pleasure of playing against, let's call him a 4-5, Federico Staxrud. He was already way better than me. He was just improving his rating by the hour.
Right.
And he did not yet employ a two-handed backhand. But he dropped a one-handed slice backhand into the kitchen to my backhand every single time.
Wow.
You know, it was beautiful. And then he had superior athleticism and sure. Did a great job of smothering when I thought I had some open court, and he just closed those angles off. So he got to be probably about a 6.2 without hitting the two-handed backhand.
Wow.
And now he has a beautiful two-handed backhand and the one-handed slice and every other element of the game.
Well, let's talk about lobs a little bit in singles. I haven't done many. It is one of those things for me where when I'm facing Matias, I might be like, why haven't I worked on my lobs more? This man is 6'5". He's got a ton of reach. I should have these down a little bit more. That's probably another very specific shot that you could work on from various points on the court, and it would really help you out in singles.
Yeah, the guys I play against have fantastic overhead smashes, and they have a small court to cover, and that should be to their advantage. Add wind and sun and pressure and my quickness, that makes their overhead a little bit more difficult for them. It's not a great defensive shot like it is in tennis when you just launch that ball up into the sky.
Right.
It's hard to buy yourself a whole lot of time, but I will employ an offensive lob. I will employ it as a third or a fifth, especially if I've got a little bit of a headwind.
Yeah.
I'll go ahead and hit a topspin lob, usually forehand, maybe a two-handed backhand, and that can be effective. I'm aiming over their backhand side, and I'm not going to sit back there and admire it. I'm using it as an approach shot. I expect to get a weak ball back from them, and I'm going to take the next one out of the air and hit it into the open court.
I think probably a great drill for that would be to get on court with someone, serve to them, they return it. You just practice lobbing that ball.
Yeah.
Differently than something like a ball machine where I almost want the inconsistency of a real person returning it so I can figure out how to lob from different parts of the court and different depths of the court.
Sure. And one of the other things that makes that offensive lob super effective is the suboptimal footwork and perhaps even a lack of a quality split step on the part of our opponents who are rushing the net. If they continue running forward, blow through what should be the split step timing, then getting a ball over their head, you know, could be super effective. And we'd be remiss in not talking more about the split step, as we do in every show, when it comes to singles. As you're approaching the non-volley zone, we've got a split step on contact from our opponents so that we can move left, right, forward.
No matter where you are.
No matter where you
are. This is actually one of the things I learned from you at that point, which was like, you'd love to be right there, but you're not. For whatever reason, maybe because you're 51, or maybe because they hit a great shot, or maybe because of whatever, you'd love to be there, but you're not. Well, you might as well be balanced where you are. You might as well split, load the springs, and get ready to move in any direction, because it's going to be better than, you know, planes, trains, and automobiles. You're going the wrong way.
How do they know which way we're going?
Yeah.
That's a really great point, Michael, that too many people blow through the split step timing in a hurry to get to where they want to be. And we've got to remind them of the definition of a split step. It's not a split stop. You don't stop there and wait for the ball to come to you. It's a thousandth of a second loading of the springs on hot lava or shards of glass, whatever works for you. And from there, we'll react to where the ball goes. And very likely, I'll make my split step 5-6 feet away from the non-volley zone. But by the time I put my paddle on the ball, I'm at the non-volley zone.
Yeah.
But I moved probably on a 45-degree angle to my right or my left.
Yeah, I remember very specifically, I kept getting stuck a little bit off center. And you're like, well, that's okay. Maybe there's one angle I couldn't get to at that point, and yeah, I would rather have been another 3 feet to the center and be able to cover that angle. But if you're not, you might as well put yourself in the best position to win. Well, that is your general singles strategy and execution episode. Very specific shots that I think you need to work on. I mean, obviously, we work on very specific shots for doubles and the dinks and the thirds and things like that. You got to do the same thing for singles. There's a new set of tools that you've got to use. It's a very, very different game. We did mention, though, that if you get stuck, you can always think, like, don't forget about your entire doubles game. And if you want to start dropping the ball, start dropping the ball and get into the two-person ritual kitchen exchange. Work on your ground strokes. Work on the depth of serve. Those are things you can do by yourself. Work on a couple of those other drills we talked about, the cross-court backhand drop. Practice cat and mouse, maybe. We haven't really talked about that, but if you want to practice cat and mouse, which would be that sort of ritual two-person kitchen exchange, probably something people never practice. It would be a great idea to practice.
It is. If I were pinned down to name one drill that you may not be currently doing, it's great for your doubles as well. Split stepping is huge here, or you're not going to do well in the game, is a two-person kitchen game.
Yeah.
Some people play this that if the ball lands beyond the kitchen, it's a fault. I'm kind of generous with that.
Yeah.
I can still get that. If it's aiming toward the kitchen,
that's
fine. But yes, folks, it's covering the entire kitchen by yourself. It's going to produce great footwork and agility and springing skills. And then you're going to need that soft touch to be able to drop a ball either cross court or straight ahead without getting that ball up, you know, for them to volley. So that's going to be beneficial for your singles and your doubles game.
Scott, good luck. You're on court in about an hour or so. Congratulations on a very successful season.
You kept yourself
intact. You managed to play an entire season of senior pickleball while also starting Boulder Pickleball, which has been massive, and a new podcast.
Not the training regimen that I would recommend, but I've been pleased with the season. Happy to announce on this show, I'm signed on for the next 2 years.
Oh, fantastic.
With NPL.
Nice.
I dig this whole setup and looking forward to finishing out this season, hopefully close to the top and then ready to rock again next year.
Love it. Folks, you've now just listened to another episode of 4.0 Pro. As always, 4.0 Pro on Instagram. If you guys have any questions for us, feel free to drop a DM on Instagram or picklehelp.com. You guys keep on rocking. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to 4.0 to Pro. For more tips, find us on Instagram at 4.0 to Pro. If you have a pickleball question, submit it at picklehelp.com. Now, get out there and dominate. But don't forget to have fun.